Return to the human realm. Leaning into pain. Suddenly, there was a lasso of energy, and my being was drawn up from the depths through oceans of turbulence. I was then pulled back into the human realm. Earth, California, Palm Springs General Hospital, my room in the cardiac ward. There was breath. I woke up, alive again. Boom! The breath restarted after stopping was abrupt and very startling. A sonic boom, an extreme sound that was more than sound, a pounding. Boom! Boom! I later learned that there had been the sound of the powered IV machine that continuously pumped antibiotics into my bloodstream. Re-entry into my normal world was shockingly painful. My skin felt ripped open. My heart was jump-starting. I felt I was being pounded by millions of taiko drums, a timpani of millions of notes, of a million different forms of pain, pounding waves of physical pain, emotional pain, excruciating pain. All sound was frightful. My body was extremely weak. My son, Ivan, leaned over me, and I whispered into his ear that I'd gone to the hell realm and had just come back. He replied, "You're very lucky, Dad. That was only a short time." It felt like a long time. I've heard that many beings get stuck in hell for aeons. Strange medical tubing with rubber suction balls protruded and hung from various parts of my body. They were clear, and one could see them gradually filling with pus and other fluids draining from the wounds. All of this was attached by metal clamps, making me feel like some kind of Frankenstein monster. My sternum had been sawed open to access my heart. Then it had been pulled closed and refastened together, bound by metal wires. The pinching and pressure of all of this was torture. I still felt cut apart, like butchered meat. It was difficult to feel anchored to this body that I had returned to. I had felt no personal fear when I passed into death, or upon entering into hell, or during my stay there. Now, to my amazement, I was experiencing tremendous fear at returning to human life. I was afraid of the pain and tried to escape from it. But the more I tried to escape, the more intense the pain became. I panicked. I tried to rest, but that didn't work. Then I remembered instructions from Trungpa Rinpoche about leaning into pain rather than trying to escape from it. He often taught, "There is no way to run away from pain. There is no way to push pain away. One has to lean into it. Just be with it." This helped me. The experience of near death gave me tremendous appreciation for my Buddhist teachers. The truth of their teaching was the only possible comfort for me in the midst of the cataclysmic turbulence and pain that had engulfed my being. Stripped, fully naked, flesh utterly ripped away, bones disintegrated, mind with no physical basis. Where there was nothing but visions of hell, there was also the purity and evenness of the protection offered by the ever-present awakened manifestation of mind and by the basic sanity that my Buddhist teachers embodied. They had so kindly pointed to it and demonstrated it again and again, until it had become inseparable from my own mind stream. The morning after my brush with death, Tinlinor Rumche called Amy from Vancouver. She had not yet had a chance to inform anyone outside the hospital about what had happened. "How is Sam?" Rinpoche asked. "I felt that he might die last night. I prayed." Rinpoche's words were not a surprise. We were very much accustomed to Rinpoche's knowing everything without being told. Wrathful wisdom. The pain in my body was excruciating, and morphine was added to the antibiotics. The morphine offered short-term relief but jangled my sense of reality. Taste sensations became more than bizarre. I couldn't see straight. Hallucinations were mixed with simple perceptions. The functioning of my body's plumbing was awry and caused me convulsive waves of painful sensations. My doctor arrived and informed me that just as mysteriously as the probable infection in my system had appeared, it had suddenly disappeared and there was no sign of it. He made bad jokes about my condition and warned me again about the possibility of becoming addicted to morphine. I volunteered to just use acetaminophen, maybe a bit too early. He then pulled out the various tubes that were inserted into my body for drainage. The feeling of having these tubes pulled out was eerie and surreal. My body was a clunky machine with nerves. Then the blood doctor appeared, an elegant, sophisticated Indian woman wearing deep burgundy lipstick. She was introduced as the infectious disease expert, who had been called in to determine whether it was an infection that had almost killed me. After looking at my chart, she icily stared into my face, unsmiling. She seemed to me like a strange blood-sucking succubus, a vampire in a white coat. I was weirdly attracted to her and at the same time repelled by her manifestation. She had told me that what had happened to me was quite mysterious. Just in case an infection reappeared, I would be pumped with massive doses of antibiotics for a few days. After she left, the nephrologist arrived. He was making sure that I did not suffer from kidney failure, because that would be the end of me. He was like some comedian from the 1950s, clueless about anything other than kidneys. His punchlines were silence. My family members were very supportive, and each spent many hours with me at a time. It was wonderful to have them near, but I felt bad that they had to listen to the complaints and meandering utterances of my extreme state. When the morphine wore off, and I was only taking acetaminophen, the pain increased and intensified. My groans and moans were peppered with expletives. I became totally entangled in the melodrama of my own confusion and self-pity, angrily yelling about simple things like getting to the toilet. Amy was hypersensitive to this bizarre behavior, and we were both becoming unhinged. At that instant, a new nurse pushed into the room. "Why are you feeling so sorry for yourself?" she demanded. Nurse Ronnie was a powerful-looking black woman with gray hair sticking out from her head. She spoke right at my face. "Why are you talking all of that negative talk? You are alive and you are recovering. I tell my grandson not to cuss. I tell him, if you got to say something, say, 'Oh, man,' that's all." Nurse Ronnie pushed this news at me up close like a Marine Corps sergeant drilling cadets, and I could feel her warmth. Whenever there was any slippage, she was right back in my face saying, "Who do you think you are making all of this fuss? Don't you know that there are so many people suffering much more than you? Get out of that fixation on yourself. You can do it, right now." She was right. Though it was impossibly difficult for me to function, there was no choice but to hear her instructions and to put them into practice immediately. Her wrath was scarier than the pains that coursed throughout my body. The truth of impermanence. Over the days, my body adjusted to the pain, and I wanted to get out of the hospital and recuperate at home. I was advised to walk and exercise as much as possible after going home and to drastically change my dietary habits. The doctor warned that my spiritual life wasn't going to be much good if I didn't take care of my physical health as well. The men and women on the nursing staff who helped guide me toward recovery were a band of angelic beings putting their patients' needs before their own needs and preferences. I have such deep appreciation for their dedication and their willingness to deal so directly with messy situations, both physical and emotional. Finally, the day arrived for me to leave the hospital. I couldn't wait. It was 120 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Blazing. I was wheeled to my car and brought home. It was going to be hard to do any walking for rehabilitation with the temperature so high. The recovery period at home was arduous. It was especially difficult to get a normal night's sleep. I would just collapse at various times during the day or night. No position was comfortable to lie or sit or stand in. Everything was torturous. Outside our air-conditioned home, it was like an oven. When you opened the front door, you were almost knocked over by the onslaught of heat. Ivan took me for daily walks an hour before sunrise, since that was the coolest part of the day. Strength crept back into my body, and gradually the pain subsided. The experience of hell seemed far behind me now, although I knew I would never see this world in the same way again. In spite of that, I was shocked that my bad habits of distraction, time-wasting, and pettiness all reasserted themselves with a vengeance. Even though I had witnessed so vividly the reality of the Four Noble Truths, the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering, the possibility of the cessation of suffering, and the ways to overcome suffering, it was just too easy to return to my habitual ways. There was nothing to do but just keep practicing with faith and diligence to burn out the confusions that obstruct awakening. After a month, I was well enough to go to Tinley Norbu Rinpoche's house to join with him and a small group of his students in an evening meditation session. Rinpoche welcomed me with a big smile and warm greetings. I was so very happy to be together with everyone again. In coming to this part of my story, I can't help recalling the unusual circumstances in which I happened to enter the orbit of Tinley Norbu. Several years after the passing of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, one of my work colleagues, Brian, asked me if I'd like to meet his teacher, Dodrup Chen Rinpoche, who was arriving from Asia at Boston's Logan Airport. I accepted the invitation and went to the airport. The plane was late. Brian became quite nervous at some point and informed me that Tinley Norbu Rinpoche had just entered the terminal. Would I like to be introduced to him? I said yes. I had read Tinley Norbu Rinpoche's book, The Small Golden Key, and had been impressed by its depth. Rinpoche, accompanied by two attendants, immediately approached Brian and greeted him. Brian introduced me, but Rinpoche paid no attention. After some more conversation, Brian again tried to introduce us. Rinpoche turned to me and started shouting at the top of his lungs about how stupid and arrogant I was, thinking I knew anything about either Dharma or crazy wisdom. To say the least, I was stunned. Suddenly, I remembered instructions that Trungpa Rinpoche had given me many years before on what to do if I were ever accosted by a high lama. At the time, I thought this a very strange prospect. Why would I ever be accosted by a lama? Nonetheless, I listened carefully to Trungpa Rinpoche's very specific instructions about exactly what to say. I now remembered this advice and followed the instructions to a T. At once, Tinley Norbu Rinpoche began laughing very hard. He then said, "Okay, okay." Dorjep Trungpa Rinpoche finally arrived and was greeted by everyone there. One of the ladies attending Tinley Norbu Rinpoche then asked me if I'd like to meet with Rinpoche at the terminal at the opposite end of the airport. I made my way to the far terminal and saw Rinpoche sitting there. His demeanor had changed, and he beckoned me to sit down next to him. He told me how much he liked the atmosphere of airports. They were like bardos, transitional places where people passed from one place to another. We went on to converse about Buddhism and politics. That time together made a great impression upon me.
Weeks later, I went to Europe to do a solitary meditation retreat.
At the end of the retreat, I received a letter from a close friend to whom I had described the airport encounter. He urged me to follow up on that encounter, telling me that Rinpoche was making me an offer. After returning to America, I went to see Thinley Norbu Rinpoche and requested to become his student. After considering it for several hours, he agreed. First, I visited him on many occasions and received teachings from him in person, and often on the telephone. His insight and kindness were unimaginable. He filled in all the areas that Trungpa Rinpoche had suggested I should look into. For at least 15 of the 21 years that I was Thinley Norbu's student, I lived in his community and practiced with him nearly every evening. I was so fortunate to have the opportunity to study under such wondrous teachers. Now, our reunion after my near-death encounter was full of poignant meaning. Just as we were about to begin the meditation session, Rinpoche casually asked me how I was feeling. I told him I was much better. "So soon?" "Yes, Rinpoche." "Well, Sam, so you think you're going to live forever. Again." Rinpoche had to remind me again the truth of impermanence to make sure. It was a bolt of wisdom lightning directed into my reborn heart with exquisite precision.